The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.
Now, please don't turn off just because we mentioned Brexit. I know lots of people are absolutely fed up with Brexit, but we have a very good reason for you to listen because our next guest has written a fascinating book. It's called A Short History of Brexit. I've been buried in it. It's written by Kevin O'Rourke, who works between UCD and Oxford universities. Kevin, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
What prompted you to write a book about Brexit while the process is still ongoing?
Well, I suppose the cheap and cheerful answer to that question is that I was asked to write this book by a French publisher. And since Brexit's a minority sport over there in France, she thought that it better come out while the thing was still ongoing.
When you say minority sport over there, I mean, we're utterly exercised by it for very good reasons, because of the border, because of the likely economic impact on this island. And continental Europe and countries like France, what do they make of it?
They're a little bit bewildered. I suppose if you're up in Calais, you might be worried. I suppose if you're in the southwest of France or somewhere else where there are a lot of British retirees, you're very aware of this, and their fishing communities would be aware of it and so on. But, you know, on a lot of the continent, it doesn't impact them anywhere near as much as it impacts us. And I think those people who are interested, they're simply bemused and they want to figure out what the hell is going on. So that's really why I wrote the
book.
Which
is possibly in common with a lot of British people as well.
Well, absolutely, yeah. And that's an important point, you know, to make to an Irish audience, I suppose, is that you cannot generalise about the British because the British are completely divided on this issue.
Divided in a number of ways. Divided between those who are ardently anti-European, those who are ardently pro-European, and those which I think suspect make up a significant number, those who simply don't really understand what being part of the European Union is at all.
Well, there are a lot of people in both of the two previous camps who, you get the sense, also don't really understand what's involved at all. And, you know, there are really basic distinctions, like the distinction between a free trade area and a customs union, or between either of those two and the single market, that people at the very top echelons in London don't seem to have gotten their head around until very recently.
Can you explain them to us simply?
Well, a free trade area involves, let's say, hypothetically speaking, the English and the French agreeing that the English will admit French goods without taxing them, and the French do the same to British goods. The difference then between a customs union and a free trade area is as follows. Under the free trade area, the French have agreed to admit British lamb, let's say, without taxing it. But they haven't agreed to admit Australian lamb without taxing it. So now imagine that the British do a free trade deal with the Australians and they say, well, now we'll admit Australian lamb tax-free. I mean, the French aren't going to want to put up with a situation where the Aussies ship their lamb free of tariffs to Britain and then it gets shipped on directly to France without tariffs. So if it's a free trade area, you're going to have border controls to make sure that the lamb coming in from Britain to France is actually British rather than Australian. So that's a free trade area. It always involves border controls. That's something that people don't understand in Britain. How do you get around that problem? Well, if everybody had the same taxes on Australian lamb, then it wouldn't matter if it were shipped into France or Britain. You know, you could let it circulate freely. But that isn't enough then to get rid of border controls altogether, because especially in a more modern economy, we have all sorts of rules and regulations concerning, for example, consumer welfare, health, safety, environmental rules. So in Europe, for example, we have rules prohibiting the importation of shrimps that have been treated with a particular type of antibiotics that can cause blindness. We need border controls to make sure that those shrimps don't come into the country. Now, if different countries in Europe had different rules, then we need to check the shrimps coming in from Britain to make sure that they weren't going to make us blind. If we all have the same rules, we don't need those border controls.
I should have said at the start, you're a professor of economic history, but your speciality is in trade. I was fascinated in the book to learn, which I think, well, a lot of people may not realise, that the British were actually really behind the idea of the single market, the thing that now they're so keen to get away from.
Yeah, well, Mrs. Thatcher was keen on markets, you know, and the bigger the market, the better. And this is her big legacy. And if you think about what defines the EU today, I don't think it's the Eurozone, the euro currency, as much as the single market, because all 27 remaining member states will be a member of the single market. And it's an extraordinary achievement, actually. And she was very enthusiastic about it. And she was also willing to push through the political reforms that had to be made to bring the single market about, because it was such a complex political negotiation that you couldn't have had a situation where every country had veto power every time you needed to decide on one regulation to put in place. And so when they were negotiating the single market, they moved to more majority voting on these issues, which meant that you could potentially be overruled. So the single market program didn't just define Europe economically. It was a major step in the direction of a more supranational Europe. You know, and so it is ironic, as you say, that Mrs. Thatcher is the person who was so enthusiastic. And then no sooner has she put this in place than she turned in a veered in a rather Eurosceptic direction.
Of course, Britain didn't join the original European Economic Community, the old EEC, and joined at the same time we did in 1973. How much of that was down to the fact that it wasn't allowed to have its own way before it actually joined up in the first place, that its plans for trading were rejected by the initial member states?
Well, the British would have been much happier if the Europeans had gone for a free trade area, because as I was saying earlier, if you have just a free trade area, then you can have a free trade deal with the French and the Germans, and you can have a separate free trade deal with the Australians. And back in the 50s, the late 40s, the early 50s, the Commonwealth was still very important to Britain, not just because they'd fought alongside with them during the war, but they had a preferential trade arrangement essentially with the Commonwealth that mattered economically. And, you know, these arrangements, they're not just about economics, they're also about who you are and what you think your place in the world is. And so they never really wanted to be in a position where they had to choose between Europe and the Commonwealth. They wanted to have their cake and eat it. And if the original six founding members of the EEC had gone with the free trade area, the British could have had their cake and eat it. But they went for a customs union with a common external trade policy, and then they had to choose, and that wasn't easy for them.
That phrase, having your cake and eating it, does that in many respects sum up the British attitude towards its relationship with Europe? Even in going out, it seems to want to have all of the benefits of being in, when it's out.
Well, like the Luxembourger Prime Minister said, they used to be in, but they had lots of opt-outs, and now they want to be out, but have lots of opt-ins. I mean, I suppose one way of understanding it is just to think about Mrs. May's difficulties in holding the Tory party together, because that's a big part of the story. And, you know, they're split between a pragmatic wing, who are, you could maybe say, in the Thatcherite tradition, they like markets and so on, so they want to continue to trade in a frictionless manner without border checks with the rest of Europe. So that's on the one hand. On the other hand, you have a bunch of people whose priority is to regain sovereignty, deregulate however they want, do trade deals with Mr. Trump, import chlorinated chicken, and all the rest of it. So what do you do if you're trying to hold those together? You have to say to the people who want to do their own thing, you can do that. And you want to say to the pragmatists, we can also have frictionless trade. Well, that's having your cake and eating it. And it turns out that you can't actually do both of those things simultaneously. That's what they continually looked for during these negotiations. And they won't be able to get it. And so they will have to choose. But that's proving terribly difficult for them. And I suppose the unfortunate thing from an Irish perspective is that the moment that this cake and eat it agenda hit the rocks of reality was when it came to the Irish border, because, you know, that's the first real border that they had to deal with. And you can't just do whatever you want and have no borders.
Of course, in advance of the 2016 referendum, it was impossible to get them to talk about the border in this island. But all they wanted to talk about was putting up borders against immigrants. And yet the irony, as you point out in the book, is that the expansion of the European Union, particularly into Eastern Europe, from 2004, was championed by the British.
It was championed by the British. And there are some people on the continent, for example, in France, who'd be cynical and who would say that the reason that the British wanted to widen Europe was that, well, they thought that if you widened it sufficiently, you'd make it impossible to deepen it, because how could you get a deep and more federal Europe if you have 28 member states? You know, so there's that element going on. And then, of course, they, like ourselves and the Swedes, opened up their internal labour markets to the Eastern Europeans before they had to and before the rest of Europe. And that has ended up being a part of the reason why they voted against EU membership in 2016.
And the irony is, though, that it was Gordon Brown as Prime Minister who started promising British jobs for British workers.
I'd forgotten that. There's an old Labour tradition, you know, that has been a little bit Eurosceptical. I mean, he was the man who kept them out of the single currency, which might have been, by the way, not a stupid thing to do. That'd be my own view now.
Although if they had gone into the single currency, would it have been far harder for them to have voted to leave the European Union?
Possibly so. Maybe the single currency would have been less dysfunctional if they'd been in it, because you can imagine when the crisis hit in 2008. I mean, there might have been some people saying, listen, we have to get out of this bloody thing. And that might have prompted reform in the Eurozone. So there are lots of counterfactual speculations that you could engage in.
But how much of this, the Brexiteer stuff, has been driven not by economic thoughts, but by notions of patriotism and nostalgia for the past, a sort of a collective psychosis that things were better for Britain as they once were, when Britain was the powerhouse rather than been part of a club?
Well, I mean, patriotism, I wonder about nationalism, certainly, you know, and nostalgia, certainly, to an extent. But you wonder what they're nostalgic about. I mean, maybe they're not just nostalgic about the fact that back in the 60s and 50s they were younger than they now are, and that's certainly something to be nostalgic about. But Britain in the 50s and 60s, economically speaking, was the sick man of Europe. I mean, they really only started to turn it around after they joined the EEC. Now, from 73 on, of course, there was the oil crisis, so that was hopeless. But eventually, they end up with this very successful service-based economy that's intimately linked to the European single market, and they have the Nissans coming in and so on.
But then you have the misrepresentations that, for example, there was an MP for Shrewsbury recently who claimed that Britain got nothing out of all the dividend of the Marshall Plan, and yet the facts are it got more money than any continental European country did.
Yeah, no, there clearly is a lot of nationalism at play here. I mean, among the ERG wing of the Tory party in particular.
But then I'm fascinated as well. You draw on the way that the world wars are commemorated in Britain, the difference, the way the British do it and the Europeans do it. Take us through that a little bit and why that's important.
I start in the book by talking about this fellow, Lord Wallace, who had been a Lib Dem member of government. And there's a memo sent to David Cameron in the early years of the Cameron-Clegg coalition where people are advised to not give any succour to the myth, I underline, that European integration had something to do with the two world wars. Now, if you tell that to somebody in France or Germany, their jaws just drop. They can't believe that you would think that. But there is a strong strand, I suppose, in British opinion that's very cynical about these claims that what Europe is ultimately about is averting world war. But that's certainly what the Continentals think. And of course, that's one of the reasons why they were so keen to back Ireland over the border issue, because they saw their own vision of Europe reflected in our own concerns. So if you go to an Armistice Day ceremony in a little French village, you know, which I do from time to time, I mean, there's the crosses and there's the tricolour sashes and there's patriotism and there's the dipping of the flag and all that stuff. But there's also typically a speech written by somebody up in Paris talking about what this is all about, talking about the sacrifices that were made not just by the French, but by the Brits, the Americans, the Canadians, the Italians, the Russians, and talking about the political lesson of all of this, which is that we need the European Union. Now, that's not, I think, it's fair to say, how Armistice Day is celebrated in the UK.
Which is all about British sacrifice and British victory.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, you know, the poppy symbolises the British armed forces.
Rather than it being a collective for all of those who died.
For all of us, you know.
Yeah. But I remember speaking to the late Peter Sutherland at length about this, and he was very much of this view that we don't understand in Ireland how important it is in Europe that the European Union is a way to stop further wars happening. Could it be that we in Ireland are a bit like the British in the sense that we regard the European project as an economic one, much more so than anything to do with war or other issues?
Well, we were spared the second war, so maybe that has been the case. But what I would say to an Irish person who would think that way is what I'd say to a British person who thinks that way, which is one of the best examples or illustrations of the thesis that Europe is above all and a political and a peace project is Northern Ireland. Because when both the UK and Ireland are in the EU, the border just becomes that much less important. And if it's that much less important, then why fight about it? The stakes have automatically been lowered, and we can see now what Brexit is doing. I mean, it's bringing borders back and it's reviving tensions, and that's not a good thing.
As a historian, as somebody who has written extensively about economic issues going back over many years, how do you see this now playing out? Because there are people who would say that, look, this will get sorted. These things get sorted. The numbers are in the House of Commons who won't allow Britain crash out of the European Union without a deal. But isn't history also full of examples of things we didn't expect to happen, that things irrationally shouldn't have happened, happening because nobody else can come up with an alternative working solution.
Yep, there's always something really bad potentially lurking around the next corner that you hadn't foreseen. And it would have been extraordinary 2 years ago to think that we might be in a position where Britain might crash out, and even more so that it might crash out accidentally, you know, which is what actually may end up happening, either because they can't get their act together in the House of Commons or because they misjudge the interests on the other side of the table. And that is a very scary thought, because it will hit us here in Ireland economically, and the border issue will be brought back. And that's a very scary thought, that there would be a border brought back. But you just have to hope that if we end up with Britain going over the cliff on March 29th, that reality will hit home there sooner rather than later, and that they will come back to the table.
But they're not really, history shows, they're not really going to care too much about the collateral damage that's caused to us.
That's for
self-interest is going to very much take hold.
No, that's for sure. But precisely because you can't have your cake and eat it, precisely because if you crash out of the customs union and the single market, you won't have frictionless trade. I mean, that will imply major costs for the British economy in terms of trade at Dover and Calais, imports of all sorts of things, exports of cars and imports of car components. That they run big risks here.
But is there a danger, again, based on history, that we'd have a little bit of the sort of the bulldog spirit, the Dunkirk thing, that they'll try and sort of go by it for as long as possible without actually being seen to give ground? That collective national pride will dictate, rather than doing the sensible thing, the pragmatic thing, that they'll try and hold out for what they want and think that Europe will blink first.
There are certainly lots of people over there who would like that to happen. But the problem for them is that the British people are completely and hopelessly divided on this issue. And while, of course, the ERG types and the UKIP types will be looking for foreign scapegoats, and Ireland would be a very likely candidate, and we can expect a lot of tough things to be said over there about Ireland if they do this to themselves. You know, half of the population are going to be blaming the government, and they're going to be blaming the ERG, and they're going to be blaming the UKIPers. So it really won't be the Blitz all over again.
And one final thing I want to put to you, Professor Kevin O'Rourke, as author of A Short History of Brexit. Are we in Ireland perhaps guilty at times of not understanding enough as to why this has happened, why a majority was in favour of Brexit, in that we're too eager to condemn them because of the consequences for us? Are there any points to what they've done where they deserve credit or understanding?
Credit, I wonder about. Understanding, that's a different thing, you know, because, I mean, the British are not alone. To have, for example, deprived communities who are justifiably pissed off with the way that things have been going for them, you know, for the last 15, 20 years. We have lots of Trump voters who, you know, are not necessarily voting for Trump because they're bigots, but just because their towns are dying because the industry's gone. They're the gilets jaunes in France. I mean, we don't have that in the south of Ireland because we didn't have traditional industry, you know, but this is not a uniquely British phenomenon. So I think that, you know, actually I have a lot of understanding for those people. And I think that they were very poorly served by Cameron and Osborne, who took away the safety nets that they needed, the welfare structures that they needed, just as their economies were beginning to confront the reality of import competition from China and elsewhere. That the Home Counties Telegraph types, the nostalgics, that's another thing. I have less understanding for them.
Yeah, and of course the irony, and of course the bitter irony is that, and the people who maybe perhaps complain the most will suffer the most as manufacturing jobs now leave in the car industry and various others. Anyway, I'm going to have to leave it there. It's a fascinating and very essential book, A Short History of Brexit. Professor Kevin O'Rourke, thank you very much for joining us here on The Last Word on Today FM.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.